This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. There are big differences between Assembly Republicans and the governor when it comes to the upcoming state budget, especially when it comes to transportation funding. The governor unveiled his 2017 to 2019 budget this spring, but Assembly Republicans offered a big part of a plan yesterday with very different approaches to transportation funding, income taxes, and more.
The new plan could shift how taxes are collected in the state in order to pay for roads, but also puts the state on the path to a flat income tax.
Matt DeFore joins us now to talk about the Assembly plan. He's a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thanks for having me.
All right, this plan, it's supposed to fix the transportation budget, but it also switches us to a flat income tax. What happened here? Connect the dots.
Well, there's a lot of dots to connect. It's really two plans wrapped into one, and the reason it's wrapped into one is because Republicans have been talking about this need, at least Assembly Republicans have been talking about the need to raise revenues for transportation to fix our road funding issue. And Governor Walker has been pretty adamant that he doesn't want to raise the gas tax. But at one point, a couple years ago, he did suggest that he would be willing to raise the gas tax if there was an offsetting reduction in taxes elsewhere. So that's kind of the template they've been working off of. And in this case, they aren't even raising the gas tax. They're actually lowering the gas tax, but they're applying the sales tax, which doesn't currently affect gas sales, and that will essentially raise the amount of taxes people pay on gas.
Right. Let's break down that part. Let's set aside the income tax part of this for the moment. We cut the gas tax, but we apply the sales tax that's applied to everything else we buy, or, you know, most things we buy, but not currently applied to the gas tax. So what? Why not just change the gas tax itself? What's the reasoning there?
Well, there's a bunch of different moving pieces here, and it gets a little confusing. But, yeah, if you reduce the gas tax by 4.8 cents, let's start with the sales tax. So they need more money for roads. So they're going to apply the sales tax, which is currently 5% in Wisconsin, and it's also there's a 0.5% in some counties. That would be applied to the gas tax. That would raise a certain amount of money, more than $300 million a year. But then they don't want drivers to have to pay more at the pump, so they're going to reduce the gas tax by 4.8 cents. And then they're also going to essentially lower what's known as the minimum markup on gasoline in Wisconsin, which is currently about 9.2%. They're talking about reducing that to 3%. And so their theory is that that would sort of be a wash. You would end up paying, you know, about the same on gas, but there'd be sort of money generated because, and it would basically be coming from companies and, you know, big, you know, national retailers and local mom and pop stores, because they're right now benefiting from that higher markup on gas, and so the money would essentially come from that to go into the transportation fund.
Right, and the idea of that minimum markup law, as I've understood it over the years, is it's supposed to prevent too hostile competition, a big company coming in, having super low prices, driving everybody else out of business, and then having a monopoly or not enough competition. That wouldn't go away completely under this, but it would be lowered, that minimum markup on gas. Is that right?
Right. It wouldn't go away completely, but you know, there is some question about whether this scheme would actually work, because right now, if a company comes in and is able to sell their gas at a low price, their competitor can look at that and say, hey, I'd have to sell under cost in order to meet that competition. And so they can actually do that. There's a way that they're allowed to reduce their price to meet competition. So it may not be that, you know, cutting that minimum markup is going to generate the kind of savings for consumers that they think. So it's a bit unclear at this point as to whether that whole scheme of trying to keep gas taxes flat would actually work. But it would generate some amount of money for the transportation fund, and they want to use that to reduce the amount of borrowing for roads in this budget.
Right. So this would bring in more revenue and allow more spending, direct spending on roads instead of borrowing. Does this mean, are they saying we could do more projects that we're currently thinking of delaying or putting on hold?
Well, no. And that's one of the things I think that might be surprising to people, is that this is not going to get them in a position where they'll necessarily be able to get the north-south I-94 interstate reconstruction back on schedule. And that's one of the sticking points for some Republicans, especially who live in that area. This is really about reducing borrowing. I mean, they pointed out that at this news conference yesterday that if you just take down that $300 million in borrowing, you know, you're going to save I think $150 million over 20 years. And so they're concerned about how the amount of money the state is spending right now for debt service on the transportation fund is over 20% of revenues. So that's really what they're targeting with this. It's not necessarily we're going to be able to do more projects. But there's other things, too, in their proposal that may help get more projects going. We'll see how it all plays out.
And then there's a new user fee for people with hybrid or electric vehicles. I guess the understanding being that, hey, they're not paying for the roads on these gas taxes because they're not buying any gas or as much gas. So this is a different user fee on vehicles that don't use gasoline. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. I think it's $125 on electric vehicles and $30 on hybrids, and this is per year. This is something, though, that was recommended by the Transportation Commission a few years ago that was recommending how to shore up the transportation fund. So, it's going to get criticized, though. I mean, is it something that sort of is creating a disincentive for people to use more fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly vehicles? But, it is true. They aren't paying as much for the roads that they use.
Talking to Matt DeFore from the Wisconsin State Journal about a new Assembly Republican transportation bill, transportation and more, actually. Let's get to the flat tax side of this. So there's the direct transportation stuff we've been talking about, and then this idea of gradually flattening income tax rates till it sounds like we all end up paying the same rate. Is that right?
Yeah, over the next 12 years or so, it gets down to 3.95% for everybody. It's graduated, so in this next biennium, the budget that we're talking about, they would cut it from 4 rates down to 3 rates. If you recall, Dale Klinga, he was 4 years ago, he came out with a proposal to cut the rates from 5 down to 4. Now they're going down to 3, and eventually they want to get down to 1. But it costs a lot of money, and it's done sort of in this, over 10 or 11 years. So, it's unclear if we'll ever actually get there, but this is sort of starting us out on that path.
And this, critics say, would disproportionately benefit people at the higher income levels.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the state has had a progressive income tax system, and the people who are criticizing this point out that the state's tax system with the sales tax and property taxes, people aren't just paying income tax. Those other taxes are also regressive in that they disproportionately affect people at the lower ends of the income scale. And that's why we've had higher percentage rates for the wealthy. Now, conservatives in the state are saying that our taxes are too high. That was the argument that was put out yesterday. And so they want to create a incentive for people with wealth to locate here and stay here.
What's been the reception to this fairly large, complicated piece of legislation?
The reception has been, we even heard a lot of hedging yesterday from the author himself, saying that the more than 40 Republican Assembly members behind him, they didn't all support everything in this plan. And so you had to wonder, is this just kind of they're throwing everything out there, sort of like, Donald Trump's art of the deal kind of stuff, just put a bunch of stuff out there, see what sticks, and then they'll have a plan. But, there were, conservative Republicans, Senator Steve Nass came out yesterday with a statement criticizing the proposal. We haven't heard too much from Governor Walker yet. He's going to review it, I guess, and talk later. But, it's going to be it's not as if this is going to all pass as one thing. I think we're going to see pieces of this make their way into the budget.
But the complicated nature of this comes from this idea that, okay, if we're going to increase gas tax to pay for roads, we have to offset it. I guess this flat income tax part of it is that offset. So, I mean, to meet those two criteria, more revenue for roads, offsetting tax cuts, it would have to be kind of a complicated plan one way or another.
Yeah, I mean, some people are wondering why they have to put these two things together. Because, again, within the transportation piece of it, there is this idea of let's keep the money that people pay at the pump level with these different pieces. And so it really is, it gets back to that grand bargain with Walker that they're trying to negotiate, where they can somehow get more revenue for roads without raising taxes. And so that's where you've got this whole, that's where all these pieces are kind of coming together. And so, yeah.
How different is this from what Governor Walker had in his budget when it came to transportation?
Well, Governor Walker's proposal relies on borrowing $500 million. It takes money from the general fund. It delays projects. And, you know, obviously doesn't have all this business with the, you know, raising, we're applying the sales tax and, you know, changing, you know, lowering the gas tax and the minimum markup law. That's not in Governor Walker's budget. But, you know, again, the biggest thing I think they're challenging him on is the borrowing and not so much on which projects are going to be picked. But I don't think they want to pick which projects. They just want to somehow provide more money for the transportation fund.
There are a lot of other pieces in this that we haven't gotten into, taking engineering jobs out of the Department of Transportation, switching to private contractors. These are jobs that were recently added, getting rid of some deductions for homeowners, I think it is, on income tax. Anything else that we haven't gotten into that stands out to you as a key, maybe controversial element of this plan?
Right. Well, you mentioned the state engineers. That was, I think, just 4 years ago where they added those positions. You know, the proposal doesn't say that's going to save any money. It's more, well, in the short term, it's more of a long-term, you know, public employees cost more than private employees kind of strategy. You know, there's on the income tax side, there are a lot of credits that they get rid of in future years, not necessarily in this budget. The biggest one that comes to mind is the first dollar credit, which is applied on people's property taxes. There's a, you know, you get, I think, somewhere between $70 or $80 or $90 of a credit on your property tax bill. And the idea of that, which I think was created back in about 10 years ago, the idea was to give everybody sort of the same dollar amount in terms of property tax savings, whereas when you do property tax relief otherwise, it depends on how much property you own, how much your property's worth. So it was sort of a democratic proposal that's, I think, more, you know, an even dollar amount for everybody as opposed to an even percentage amount. They're getting rid of that with this proposal, although not for another couple years would that sort of start to phase in. And when you look at the proposal, what that does is it saves them from having to say that, you know, for example, in 2029, you know, the income tax, flat tax, is going to cost the state $2.7 billion in revenue. So when you say, oh, well, we're not going to give out this first dollar credit, you know, you can reduce that amount by about $150 million. So it's trying to pay for these huge tax cuts.
A lot of moving parts here, Matt. Thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Rob, thanks so much for having me.
Matt DeFore is a state capitol reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about a new transportation funding plan that GOP members of the state assembly unveiled yesterday, talking about how it could differ from the governor's proposed budget. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. New evidence has been found in Iowa that a pesticide that is widely used by farmers has been found in the drinking water.
The class of pesticides known as neonicotinoids differs from other pesticides in many ways. They've been on the radar of many farmers and scientists lately due to their potential ties to the decline of the bee population.
Ben Guarino joins us now to talk about these pesticides in the Iowa drinking water and what it could mean for people. He writes for the Washington Post Speaking of Science section. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it sounds like for the first time, scientists have found evidence of neonicotinoids in water. What have they found?
That's right. So University of Iowa environmental engineers working with the U.S. Geological Survey monitored drinking water for a pesticide called neonicotinoids, or neonics for short, and they found what they were looking for. Now, this was very, very low doses, and I want to emphasize that there's wasn't alarming. In fact, one of the Iowa scientists who found the pesticide told me he kept drinking the water that they had found it in. But this was the first time that anyone had looked for it, and they found it.
Were the scientists looking in particular at waterways in general, or were they looking at what comes out of our tap, at drinking water?
They were looking at drinking water specifically. So this was done in an area in Iowa where there's a lot of agriculture, and neonics are some of the most popular agricultural pesticides on the market right now. So there should be some in the waterways if agriculturists were using them, and that's what they found. So they were in the Iowa River watershed area, and those ended up in the drinking water as well. What the University of Iowa environmental engineers were particularly interested in was whether or not the water filtration system, both on the University of Iowa campus and in Iowa City, would be able to remove some of these pesticides.
And I want to get to that question, but first, can you give us a little primer on what neonics are, how they work as a pesticide?
Sure. So what they do is they are able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier in insects, which means that there are a lot of chemicals that can get into the bloodstream but can't get into the brain. But these pesticides can do that. They get into the brains of insects, and they act as neurotoxins, essentially. There's a little bit of a debate, actually it's quite a big debate, about whether or not these insecticides have deleterious impacts on bees. This study didn't look at that. But there's also no evidence one way or the other about what these insecticides have on human health. The EPA hasn't set any levels, mainly because there hadn't been until this point any real evidence that humans were being exposed to them.
You do write about a couple of studies, one looking at low-level exposure and another at low-level chronic exposure, I think it was. Not a lot, as you said, to go on, but what is there that we know about the effect on humans?
So we know that chronic exposure can have some adverse effects. One Japanese study in particular found that there is evidence of memory loss, but again, these tend to be in situations where people would be repeatedly exposed to this, either because they're working with these pesticides, manufacturing it, or they're folks who are out coating their vegetables and things with it, not on the consumer side.
Now, you said the EPA doesn't have determined levels about what might be safe for people. Why don't we have that information right now?
You know, that's a really good question. One of the common themes that came out when I was talking to researchers was that this is really an area that needs more study. I think at this point, because these levels really were so low in drinking water, at the levels of exposure, certainly wasn't alarming, so there hasn't been a concentrated effort that the EPA, which has limited resources at where it can look, to devote looking at the neonics in particular.
We're talking with Ben Guarino right now. He writes for the Washington Post, Speaking of Science section, and we're talking about a new research that found that a popular pesticide has been found for the first time in drinking water in this country. And Ben, you were getting at the filtration question about how effective various filtration methods are at removing this pesticide, these neonicotinoids. What do we know about that?
That's right. So one of the things that makes neonicotinoids so effective is that they are small molecules and they are polar molecules. So if you think back to basic chemistry, where like dissolves like, if you have a polar molecule in water, it dissolves. So unlike a lot of other pesticides, which might stick on to soil, and we're really good at removing soil in filtration systems, things that tend to dissolve are tougher to remove. So on the University of Iowa campus, which had a sort of more conventional filter, I believe it was a sand filtration system, the neonic pesticides were able to get through that system because it's meant to target clay, dirt, or other particles, as well as pathogens like bacteria. But there was a different water treatment technique in Iowa City. It's an activated carbon filter system, and that was able to block 100% of some of the pesticides, as well as 94 or 85% of other ones. So the researchers called that a pleasant surprise. So it's not all bad news. It certainly looks like there are techniques available. Perhaps they're a little more expensive, but not more so than the sand filtration systems that can stop these pesticides from getting into the drinking water.
And you mentioned areas where more research is needed to figure out exactly, for instance, the effect on humans. We're still waiting for more research on a possible link between neonics and bee die-offs. So what is the next frontier of research?
You know, that's another great question. I think one thing that will come out of work like this is this was done in a small area around Iowa City and other agricultural areas there. But I think the next steps would be to look at this at a broader national level to get a baseline across, because we simply don't know. You know, one of the neat things about this study is that we're getting better at being able to identify these really, really tiny amounts of trace pollutants in water. So it's a combination of people looking for something that they hadn't before, but also the technology that we have available to us that is able to identify really, really tiny traces of maybe contaminants that we hadn't seen. So applying these techniques in other places would certainly be some big next steps.
You also mentioned one of the studies looking at exposure to neonics was a Japanese study. Is this class of pesticides popular worldwide, or is it especially widely used here in the United States?
It's certainly widely used here in the United States. Off the top of my head, I can't speak to everywhere else, but one of the neonicotinoids called imidacloprid is among the world's best-selling insecticides. It has sales of over $1 billion a year, and with that widespread use has certainly come one of the reasons this class of pesticides has come under fire is because it's so widespread, and that's why people argue that it might have some of these damaging effects on bees and other pollinators.
And Ben, as we wrap up, you spoke to several scientists in your reporting for this piece. What was your sense about how concerned they were?
Well, as I mentioned, the environmental engineers at the University of Iowa, one of the researchers I spoke to, he said he was continuing to drink the water even before they upgraded their sand filter to the carbon-activated filter after the study was completed. But because the levels were so low, he didn't find it alarming at all. I think what they see this more as a call to more research, a call to action to say, you know, now that we know that it does exist in the drinking supply, we should continue to monitor this to make sure it doesn't become a problem down the line.
Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
Ben Guarino writes for the Washington Post Speaking of Science section, and he joined us to talk about a new study that shows that a pesticide widely used by farmers has made its way into the drinking water in parts of Iowa.